Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to SubChina's original stories and columns on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China. From the latest on the trade war to the ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, well over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I'm coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. Let me start today with a confession. For many years, I had a mild but definitely discernible aversion to the whole xun gun idea. Xun, to search for, to seek, gun, roots. So seeking roots. At least when I first started going to China, it's what everyone in China assumed any overseas Chinese person they encountered was doing there in the first place. This whole exercise of Chinese people, you know, from the diaspora, often many generations removed from China, were going back to China to discover their ancestry, to meet living relatives, to, you know, see the old village or whatever. In retrospect, now that I no longer have that aversion, I can see that it grew out of a couple of things. One minor piece of it was a suspicion that I harbored that, you know, encouraging or even applauding people in this whole roots-seeking exercise in China would subtly undermine this right that a lot of Asian Americans were fighting for, that this idea that they should be able to demand to be seen as having no ancestral connections at all, to be as American or as Canadian or whatever as anyone else, as an Irish guy or a German guy or whatever. But actually, that whole fight was never something I was, you know, I didn't have a ton of skin in it. I wasn't particularly committed to it. And thinking back on why it bugged me when people asked me if I'd come to China to do the root-seeking thing, it was that it implied somehow that I had lost connection with my own roots. And ever since I was pretty young, I prided myself on knowing quite a bit about my family history, of being familiar enough with the historical events in the lives of my parents, my grandparents, and even, you know, back a few more generations, so I could slot the stories that they told me into my knowledge of China's modern history. And just to give it context, I guess for me personally, the assumption that I was in China to xun gun, to search for my roots, just kind of rubbed me wrong. I was told myself that even if I had no blood connections to China whatsoever, I would have just found it to be the most interesting thing happening in my lifetime, and I still would have wanted a front row seat to it. I would have found my way to China. It was just independently compelling. I still actually kind of think that. And when it came to other people, I often thought I smelled something ignoble in root-seeking. I was conjuring up these scenes of the triumphant return of someone to their village, their ancestral village, these privileged and well-heeled denizens of the first world, exaggeratedly signaling their foreignness while deigning to walk amongst the unwashed, beaming their big, orthodontically corrected white smiles and dispensing little gifts from civilization, offering fulsome and very condescending praise of the quaint and rustic lives of their distant cousins. But over the years, I changed my mind about this. Part of it was that China had changed, and part of it was that the U.S. had changed. And another part, which is salient to today's discussions, is that just before I left China 3 years ago, I heard about a very cool little startup founded by a lawyer from the Netherlands who had been working in Beijing. His own ancestors had come from southern China long ago, gone to Indonesia, and he'd been curious about his roots in Fujian. And so he decided to learn all he could about his ancestry.
And he found out quite a bit, it turns out, and the very keen interest that other people of Chinese descent consistently showed in his own genealogical explorations gave him this idea to start this company, My China Roots. They're still going strong today, and we've finally gotten around to getting this show together. The founder's name is Huihan Li, and he joins us from Seneca East in Beijing. Huihan, welcome at last to Seneca.
Hey, guys. Good to be here.
Yeah. Huihan, you're joined by two of your colleagues as well. You've got Chrislyn Chu, who's there in Beijing, as well as Clotilda Yap, who joins us from London. So welcome, Chrislyn, and welcome, Clotilda.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Kaiser. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm really delighted we could finally make this happen. So let's start off with each of you and what it was that first got you interested in genealogy more broadly, and then in your own ancestry more specifically, enough that, you know, you wanted to start, in Huihan's case, or join a company that was doing specifically this kind of work. So what lit the fire for each of you?
Well, I think you captured the essence of my story quite well. I mean, I started with genealogy, I guess, long before I knew the word genealogy itself. I was just always really interested in stories. And I always used to ask my grandfather and my father about stories of our family history in Indonesia. But they were never able to tell me about China because that was just too long ago. That was seven generations ago, as I later found out. So as I grew up in my teens in Holland, in a very Dutch countryside environment, I just started being increasingly curious about China and what the country would be like, and, you know, questions about our own family. If we're Chinese, then why don't we speak Chinese? What does it mean to be Chinese? And why do we basically lose all the rituals and cultural customs that are Chinese? So those questions just stuck in my mind. And it was only after I finished my law degree that I thought, okay, this is really the time to go, if ever. So I gave myself 6 months and I just went. I just started studying the language, which was, of course, the first key goal and obstacle. Because I think, especially growing up in the West, if you don't speak Chinese, and I think this resonates with a lot of overseas Chinese, whenever I would walk into a Chinese restaurant and waiters would start speaking Chinese to me and I wouldn't be able to respond in Chinese, they'd just give me this look of horror of what kind of half human being are you that you don't speak Chinese. So I grew up also feeling a little bit sort of insecure, I guess, and I didn't even know whether I needed to feel embarrassed, but about not being able to speak it. But, you know, there were a lot of question marks in my mind about Chineseness as a concept. So, yeah, I went in my mid-20s, and as I worked in government affairs and consulting, I started digging into my family roots on the side as a hobby. And that's how I basically discovered the impact that it had on me. I went to some ancestral villages on my father and my mother's side, and I really felt, I had never felt such a deep impact, such a personal connection to myself, to history, to my, also to my parents, my family, and my grandfather. And as I started speaking to other people about my experience, I noticed the effect that it had on them. So they asked me to help them.
Seven generations. Yep. So that I mean, if you take 30 years as a generation, I mean, we're talking about 200
right. Yeah,
or more years ago. We're talking about early 18th century. Wow, that's quite an early departure. Wow, it's fascinating. I mean, and we'll get into what you were able to find. What about you, Clotilda? What lit the fire for you?
So I was born in the UK in London, but I come from a mixed background. My father's Malaysian Chinese. He's third generation Chinese Malaysian. And my father himself never really knew how to speak Chinese besides a little bit of Hokkien. So growing up in the UK, besides going to eat dim sum over the weekends, there was nothing really Chinese about us. And on the flip side, my mum's French, and me and my brothers were all raised as very proud French people. So I always felt closer to that side of the family. But the strange thing was I always identified myself as Chinese. So that was the cool, special thing about me that I would tell my friends. Going to a French school in the UK is not that diverse. So that was the cool thing that I could say about my background. And it was the same within my French family. So I think early on, I had this need to sort of bridge that gap, and I ended up studying Chinese at university. And while I was studying in Beijing, I thought, heck, while I'm here, I may as well, you know, go see where my father's family used to come from. So I went on a backpacking trip by myself and met some distant relatives and learned some really interesting stories about my great grandfather, whom I had never met. And it was at that point I thought, wow, this is such a great journey. More people should do this kind of thing because it really makes you feel connected. And I thought, oh, I could start my own charity or company, whatever, that helps others retrace their roots back in China. But obviously I found a company that already did that, which was My China Roots, and the rest is history.
Yeah, well, you know, so it's interesting. So far, both of you have had stories that are more pull than push. I mean, I imagine that for some people who grew up in the Chinese diaspora, they feel excluded from the society they live in, whether, you know, in Europe or in the Americas or wherever. And that is what makes them take an interest in their ancestry in the country that they come from. But yeah, that's really, it seems not to have been the case with either of you. What about Chrislyn? What about you?
Yeah, so for me, I was born in the United States, but my parents are both born and raised in Malaysia. So growing up, they would always, over the summertime, bring us, quote unquote, home to Malaysia to visit family. So that's where I associated as like my cultural, ethnic kind of home outside the US, not so much China. But obviously we are all ethnically Chinese, and Malaysia itself, it's like a melting pot or a salad bowl of the East, as my dad likes to describe it. And America as well is its own melting pot. So both very multicultural in different ways. And in each of those settings, I felt very much, I would keenly feel how I was caught in between and right. How like my identity would shift depending on the context I was in. And so like in the US, I would feel far more Malaysian than if I was in Malaysia. In Malaysia, I would feel very un-Malaysian, right? My parents, they can speak, you know, five languages or dialects between the two of them, but growing up, it was more like their secret language if they wanted to, you know, talk about me and my brother, about his understanding. So, right. Yeah, like, and language is a huge, you know, that's the way that you access just culture, the mindset, be able to connect with people. So having that barrier, I think, has always been kind of this undercurrent of shame or like not enoughness or whatever being Chinese is. There was always that sense of deficiency, I think. And so, yeah, for me, about, I guess, a little bit over a year now, I decided to take my leap, similar to the others here, of wanting to take time to spend time on the mainland, the motherland, the fatherland, China, and actually, like, build my own story, my own connection with this place, versus just base it off of the stories of, you know, earlier generations. I guess I have one grandfather, my mother's father, who was actually born and raised in China, so I got to spend some time in the fall to visit his village, and it was great to just close some gaps, like, wow, you know, my favorite dishes in Malaysia, and, like, we're a huge foodie culture, like, some of these actually originated in southern China, you know, in Fujian province, and oh, this is really where it came from. Wow. And so these parts of myself that I had separated, like, oh, China is this one, Chinese is this one part, Malaysia is this other part, America is this other part, I could just start to, you know, food as a love language, for example, that was one area where I felt those gaps start to close and be like, you know, they're not so different after all, they are connected. And I think just, I mean, for me in the US, I grew up in the Northeast in New Jersey, but I went to college in the South in North Carolina, and just feeling kind of caught in between some of the racial dynamics where the narratives in the US are very literally black and white. And there's still a huge underrepresentation of Asian American history and migration stories in the story of America. A lot of this leap was very much driven the push that I felt was like, I'm tired of saying like, what's not my story? Like, oh, it's not that, yeah, but like, what is my story? What is our story? What's our family story? And so that kind of led me back here to try to be like, all right, like, let's try to experience this and let it actually speak to me so I can have a sense of, you know, why am I proud or glad that I'm associated with this culture? And then invite other people into it as well.
Well, I'm just a stone's throw from your alma mater, from Duke, just down the road here. It's funny, I'm on Main
Lucky
Street.
Lucky you.
Yeah. You know, what strikes me is really interesting is that all three of you are from diaspora, or your roots are in diaspora countries, and not, well, originally in China, but via a Southeast Asian country, either Indonesia in Huihan's case or Malaysia in the case of both you, Clotilda, and Chrislyn. I wonder if that's mere coincidence or whether that sort of interposition of another country maybe adds to the mystery, the allure, the sense of wanting to find out. I mean, because in the case of somebody like me, it's just quite direct, right? I mean, my parents were both born in China, went to Taiwan, you know, arguably another country, but maybe not. And then, you know, went to the States directly. So there was no non-Chinese country in the middle. Do you think that was a factor for any of you?
For me, it was, because, like, I grew up with stories about Indonesia, and I grew up learning about Indonesia, but never about China. So for me, it was this missing link. But I think if I look at the people that we help today, we get people from, like, whose ancestors have moved twice or have migrated twice, but we also have people that just came, that whose ancestors came from China, and they just settled in the place where the clients live today. So in that respect, I would say it's quite coincidental that the three of us are from, you know, different places. But the thing is, we have people from all ages and all backgrounds. We have people that are in their early 20s.
Working for you, you mean?
Oh, sorry, yeah, people that we help. I mean, clients, customers.
Oh, so, okay, right. Yeah, let's get into your clients. I mean, obviously, there's a growing interest right now. Otherwise, right, your company wouldn't be flourishing the way that it is. Do you suppose that China's rise has been a factor in this growing interest? I mean, now China is a pretty modern country. It's got a lot to be proud of, at least economically, if not politically. It's got, you know, for whatever reasons, people are maybe feeling more comfortable with pride in their cultural heritage. They have these sort of stirrings of these feelings of connection to China. They all of a sudden want to, you know, understand their origins there better. Is that a plausible theory?
I think so, yes. And maybe not so much just active pride, but at least less ashamed. I mean, it's just also easier. I would think, in addition to China's rise, just simply the rise of the internet and the barriers that have been broken down in terms of just traveling to China, just Googling China, and just at least satisfying the early stages of a curiosity, and just the awareness that it's actually quite possible now to do these this type of research. That's definitely contributed too.
So, Chloe, you work on the customer side. So who are these customers? Where are most of them? And from talking to them, what are some of the things that motivate them? And I guess, why are so many of them women? Apparently, it's very heavily gendered, right? I mean, there's way more women who are taking you guys on.
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer your last question, but definitely speaking to customers is the favorite part of my job, precisely because we get such a broad range of people of diverse backgrounds. So the vast majority, I would say, come from the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but we do get loads of requests as well from Southeast Asia, so places like Singapore, Malaysia, Philippines, and quite a few as well from Central America, so the Caribbean, quite a bit from places like Jamaica. And I'm very excited to say we've just confirmed our first South American client as well. So very exciting news, yeah. And we get quite a few people who are, I want to say, middle-aged or retirees who have quite a bit of spare time and want to research their heritage for the next generation. So
they
perhaps, you know, knew a little bit about where their parents or grandparents came from, but they want to just solidify that so that their kids and grandkids have traces and have references to start from. But we also, of course, get young parents who have just had kids and are sort of questioning what kind of stories they want their own kids to inherit. So yeah, it's very interesting to come across all these different kinds of interests.
I imagine that among those young parents, some of those customers were probably parents of adopted children or adoptees themselves, you know, who were maybe born in the 90s and are now into their young adulthood and are very curious about it and probably have approached you. Have you had many queries from among these, you know, thousands of young girls mainly who were adopted from China?
Yes, we do get quite a lot of those requests from both adoptees and their parents who are either European or American but want to do this for their children. But it's very, very tough in China for obviously emotional and practical reasons. and the institutions that you would have to contact in order to find, you know, traces of biological parents are often government institutions who either don't keep records or don't want to share the records.
Right.
So it's very, very difficult.
At least that is a fairly well-trodden path, right? I mean, a lot of people know how to do this sort of who were my biological parents research. I imagine that's something that has been going on for quite some time, well before you guys got started. So at least it's a well-trodden path.
That's true. But it's also, for many adoptees, interesting to basically just come back to China. And even if we don't find the biological parents, just going back to the orphanage or, for instance, the police station that they might have been found in front of, or foster parents that, you know, they would have ended up after the orphanage and before being adopted overseas. A lot of that really awakens a lot of emotions too. So even though finding biological parents is often challenging, there is a lot of other research work that we can do that is still emotionally valuable to these adopted girls.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'll add is, like, I spoke with one girl who came back where she was born, she grew up in Spain and identifies as Spanish, feels very Spanish culturally. And she told me when she came here, like, she didn't feel like she necessarily wanted to be more Chinese or that being Chinese necessarily meant anything to her. She was just curious. And it was more of an intellectual curiosity, perhaps. And afterwards, she discovered that, oh, wow, actually, the nurse or like the lady at the orphanage that she was adopted from had actually wanted to adopt her, but like couldn't for some reason, where it was like financial.
Oh, wow.
So in that moment, like she kind of got to meet the woman who might have been her mother, who almost was her mother, who wanted to be her mother. So that was like,
wow,
you know, unexpected. And I think, you know, kind of flipped that switch from being an intellectual curiosity to being that more emotional one that she couldn't have imagined. So you never know.
Yeah, I've definitely found myself imagining that other life I might have had. You know, my parents were from kind of elite families in adjoining counties in the same province, and their parents knew one another. They were both the sort of eldest siblings oldest, you know, boy and oldest girl. There's that faint chance that they might have gotten married. And so I always imagined for myself like a life that might have been in China. Anyway, let's talk about how you guys do the work. I'm sure the resources that your various customers have available to them, you know, they must vary pretty widely, but maybe you have a sense of who a notional average customer might be and what she has available as a sort of starting point. Like what's in that box of stuff they can give you to begin?
So the main things that we always ask our customers to provide at the start is the name of their ancestors or as many ancestors as they can in Chinese characters. And this is super important because, of course, when we go back to China and do the research, locals or distant relatives, they won't remember that person as Francis Fong or whatever his westernized name is. They will remember his Chinese name. And then the second thing that we ask for is the address or the name of the village, town, county, etc., that the ancestor came from in China, also in Chinese characters. So the key challenge here, of course, is that a lot of Chinese immigrants, when they left and they went to Peru or the US, they would have transcribed their names depending on the dialect that they spoke, but also depending on the language that is spoken in the country of arrival. So you have different ways of romanizing names and places that can make it a bit difficult sometimes to retrace the original Chinese characters.
Right.
So, but there are a lot of clues that most people have that they don't realize they have. For example, if their grandparents were buried in a Chinese cemetery, it's likely that there are Chinese characters on the grave. So even if our clients can't read Chinese, they have access to this really important clue. And Chinese graves have not only the names of your ancestors, but also their hometown back in China, if you're lucky. So that's a key.
And they often have names of spouses and descendants and parents even.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm sure everyone's got like those a photo album with some sepia-toned photos, and sometimes they'll have, you know, a name scrawled on the back, or Chinese characters appearing somewhere in the photo that might give clues.
Yes,
yeah?
Exactly. Especially because you have to remember these are our ancestors who first left China. They were away in a completely foreign place, often with few people that they knew who spoke the same language as them, unless they really tried to seek out those areas or those Chinatowns where they could find, you know, locals to them. So they would most likely have written back home and sent money back home. So if your family has kept, you know, stray envelopes or things from that time, you could also potentially find an address or names of the people that your grandparents corresponded with, and that can be a really good clue too.
So there's sort of the holy grail, though, of genealogical research in China, which of course is the zupu or the jiapu, right? Huihan, can you explain what these things are, and how often are you able to actually find one that's a, you know, that is of the clan or of the family that's doing
sure.
research?
Yeah, so a jiapu or a zupu, they're basically clan books or family history books. And especially in the past 1,000 years since the Song Dynasty, families have been maintaining these books. So it's not just a rich, noble family that would keep these books. It's basically across the board. And it goes back to Confucianism, really, to the value of maintaining records about your ancestors, knowing who they were and respecting them that way. So these books, really, they have family trees, but not just family trees. They have sections that discuss the biographies of certain renowned ancestors. They contain histories about the village itself, histories about the clan and where the clan was, where the ancestors were before they moved into the last village that the ancestors were. So it basically goes back hundreds or sometimes even thousands of years in the past.
Yeah, so really the Holy Grail.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So one of the questions that we get very often is, well, hasn't everything been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution? And a lot of it, of course, has. But very importantly, in the South, there was a big resurgence in the 80s and 90s of clans getting back together and basically elderly villagers doing a collective brain dump and re-establishing and republishing their clan zupus and jiapus. So that's one. Number two is also in the South, it being further removed from Beijing. There were actually a lot more of these books saved than in the North.
Yeah, yeah.
Number three, in the South, has mostly in history been more, I guess, valuing cultures and Chinese history than the North in general. So to answer your question, you know, how often does it happen that a family can still find its family book? It actually happens very often and a lot more than you would think. Our success rate is around 80%. So, you know, that's typically, in the majority of cases, we would be able to find a jiapu.
Wow, that's impressive.
Also, to go back to your earlier question about what sources are needed, what information is needed for us to be able to start research. One of the things that I'm really excited about is that the bigger we've gotten, the more overlapping family histories we've been seeing. So in essence, this means that as we grow bigger, and especially as we're now building a large-scale database of these clan books online, the less information will typically be needed by clients to start research.
Oh, that's terrific. You got to tell me a little more about the digitization of, or the whole clan book sort of archive that you're building online. We'll get to that in a second, but I wanted to ask you first, you mentioned that the resources are richer in the South. But it also seems to me that a huge proportion, a huge percentage of your clients actually do ancestrally come from the two provinces, from Fujian and from Guangdong. So a lot of your work takes you down to southern China, to the Pearl River Delta, and to you know, the coastal cities of Fujian. What have you learned about the circumstances and the reasons for people leaving China? I mean, there's some, you know, that are fairly obvious to a lot of people. 1849 gold rush in California and so forth, the railroad building of the 1860s. Now, I remember you telling me about certain groups of people in the diaspora who have, you know, real patterns of emigration. And in particular, you talked about this cluster of villages in southern China where, like, all the Jamaican Chinese come from. can you talk about the Jamaican Chinese?
Sure, yeah. So the issue is that basically one wouldn't pack up their whole life to just start a new life in a place thousands of miles overseas if you just randomly, right? People would typically go where their uncle could already help them find work, which means that there were established networks of people going from A to B overseas. So if, for instance, you take a look at the Chinese people of Chinese Jamaican heritage in, let's say, Toronto, New York, and Miami, those three cities in Northern America, you'll find that they, for like 90% of those cases, they will come from an area that is of a 30-mile radius in modern-day Shenzhen. And they will have been... Yeah. So
Wow.
That's how historic migration patterns basically evolved. They started at one place, and then, you know, people followed one another because they could help one another in a new place. So in this particular case, in a very small area in Shenzhen, people started moving to Jamaica about 100 and more years ago. And then in the 60s and 70s, a lot of these Chinese Jamaicans, they moved, for instance, to New York, Miami, and Toronto, where they still live today. So this migration, historical migration mapping, is one of the things that we're also very excited about and what we're doing at the moment. Because, you know, again, it goes back to the point of the more you map, the more people that have actually not too much information we can help.
So I mentioned just now that a lot of your clients are from Fujian or from Guangdong province, but there's another geography of China that in more recent years, at least, has been sending a lot of people in diaspora. A lot of it's of course, Wenzhou in Zhejiang province. I understand that there's more and more people sort of with Wenzhou roots who are now taking an interest in your services. Is that correct?
That is correct. I mean, in the beginning, when we started My China Roots, I was really focused on Fujian and Guangdong because I figured that, like me, the people most interested would be people that don't really speak Chinese anymore and don't really know where they're from in China anymore. To our surprise, our pleasant surprise, one of the another type of client does actually still know where they're from and they still speak Chinese. However, because they've migrated overseas, for them a key motivation is the next generation. So they see their kids being completely Americanized or Dutchified or however you want to call it. And they feel, the parents feel, that it would be valuable to still transfer knowledge about China, where they were from. So yeah, our family websites definitely help with transferring all the awareness of roots to the next generation.
So what about historical events in China that produced waves of migration, sort of the push, like maybe the Hakka Punti Wars or
the Taiping Rebellion.
Taiping Rebellion, the chaos of the Taiping.
Exactly.
Yeah. Can you talk about what you've seen sort of historically as events in China that produced the biggest out-migration waves?
For sure. I mean, there were typically always push as well as pull factors. So push factors include, like you said, in Hakka cases, the Taiping Rebellion. Like after the Taiping Rebellion, there was a big backlash against the Hakka. And like thousands, many, many thousands of Hakka had to flee the mainland. But you also had a lot of instances of like floods, natural disasters in Guangdong and earlier also in Fujian. Basically poverty. People were just same with famines, and people were so in such dire straits that they had to find ways overseas to make money and to survive, essentially. So a lot of these people, they gathered like families or villages, they pooled their money and then ended up sending one or two of the younger boys, typically aged like 17, 18, 19, to go overseas and make money in order to send it back to home. But you know, where do you go? Do you just go anywhere? No, you don't just go anywhere. So there had to be pull factors.
You go where your uncle was,
and your uncle went there because there was a pull factor that pulled him to certain economic, a certain environment that was good to make money. So basically, these were environments where European colonizers were, and especially after the abolition of African, like Western and Central African slavery throughout the 19th century, that slavery, that labor, was replaced by a lot of Chinese and Indian laborers. So these came to be known as coolies, or contract laborers. So they were their labor environment was slightly more regulated than slaves, but still they lived in dire conditions.
Yeah, I mean, these were they were mining on the Guano Islands, exactly. And stuff like that, right? I mean, it was pretty awful.
Tin mines in Malaysia, plantations, sugar plantations in Cuba, you name it. So those are pull factors. You mentioned another pull factor like the gold rush or the transcontinental railroad in North America. So those are, yeah, they're push factors as well as pull factors that made people leave and go someplace.
Support for this week's show comes from Brattle Street Educational Counseling. Stressed out about college applications, Brattle Street Educational Counseling can help. They provide guidance throughout the whole process and offer workshops for students looking to work in small groups at a rigorous pace. The workshops include hours of one-on-one attention. From college essays to standardized test prep to interviewing and applications, Brattle Street offers support for any student. Brattle Street, BRATTLE Street.com, helping you get where you want to go. Let's talk about what the actual product, the deliverable that you offer is. What is it that you end up putting into the hands of your customers? Because I found that to be really remarkable, beyond what I had originally expected, and really a pretty compelling thing. Can one of you talk about what you typically deliver?
Yeah, so typically our researchers, they will serve as the, you know, on the ground hands and feet and context, you know, interpreters on behalf of the diaspora, like our clients scattered around the world who may not have like the means to come in person or the language, right, to come and understand. So basically it's whatever they're curious about, and then we'll write it up typically in a report that will summarize some of the histories that we find, like if we interview some of the villagers, right, in their ancestral village, or find relatives, we'll conduct like oral history interviews, we'll translate it, basically compile it, and then if they want, also contextualize it, you know, with historical events to paint this broader picture so they can see how, you know, their family's generational migrations dovetailed with all those, you know, push and pull factors that we just discussed.
Yeah, that's part of it that I found particularly compelling, is that sort of, this is what, you know, was happening in this family's world during this time. These are the historical events that might have been sort of inflection points in their lives. That was all really well done. And the writing is gorgeous, actually.
Thanks.
No, but we feel very strongly about going beyond names and dates and telling stories. I mean, that's how history comes to life, and that's how it becomes valuable. And that's how it gets transferred onto new generations, which we feel very strongly about too, the preservation of culture and stories.
Yeah, it's really all about bringing history to life. I mean, for me, I was a very poor history student. I could honestly care less. all the, you know, dates and everything just leaked out of my ears the moment they entered. And it was only really through fiction, I think, that history came to life for me. And Chinese history in particular only came to life for me once I started reading like graphic novels that dealt with Chinese history. really good recommendation is Boxers and Saints, which deals with like,
yeah, I have that. Yeah,
opium wars and all that. So, yeah, I think our goal really is to just bring that history to life. And it's exciting because now with, you know, all the technological visualization tools that we have today, it's like right now our big challenge, our big curiosity here is how do we take that story data and create a portal of sorts, a family portal that can help connect a family that's scattered around the world. Like, for example, my mom is the youngest of 9 children. And so our family is literally everywhere. And if, you know, one uncle has one story and another cousin who grew up with our grandparents in Malaysia has all these other stories, but then so-and-so spoke at the funeral and learned this other thing. Like, if everyone's scattered around the world, how do we have this unified space to share our data, you know, and combine our clues, combine our traces? Yeah, so, like, you know, the experience, a very common experience of the roots tracing journey when you're there in person is to just sit around a family table with your relatives, and you just sit there and you know, people are talking over each other, finishing each other's sentences. Someone's like, oh, I have a photo, let me pull it up for you. Someone's like, oh wait, someone, you know, and it's a blissful chaos. It's very messy and it's awesome, but it's very hard, you know, to record cleanly, right? Like, imagine trying to just record the audio from that, let alone the visuals all of that, you know. It's a total headache. And so right now we're trying to figure out, like, okay, what are all those data streams? What are all the possible ways of organizing those stories? Because they're, you know, stories are nonlinear too. And right now we're building that portal where family can just come and combine all their data, arrange it around, you know, the ancestors they're interested in, connect with existing relatives, just kind of your all-in-one family reunion kind of table, but digitally.
Oh, wow. That's super cool. So what are the skill sets that you guys have to look for when you're hiring researchers? I mean, I can't imagine that there have been people dedicated to this particular profession for a very long time. I mean, are they reporters? Are they folklorists? Are they just sort of people, you know, with good communication skills, people who can type really fast? What do you look for?
Well, for the most important work, which is basically going to the villages and talking to people, I think communication skills and a passion for stories and for collecting stories is crucial. Doesn't really matter if they studied journalism or history or archaeology. I mean, our team has studied all of the above. But it's really most important is that they have a passion for talking to people and collecting the stories, because there's so many stories and that are just wonderful to tell, big stories like client stories. I mean, with big high up KMT generals that were murdered in gruesome manners, but also like smaller stories of, for instance, a missionary great-grandmother who went to Hong Kong and then fell in love, but then because of the mix, they weren't accepted because she fell in love with a Chinese cook, so they were basically, what's the word? Ostracized. That's, yes,
ostracized.
Exactly.
I remember, I can't remember which one of you I was talking to about this, but somebody suggested that there's often some scandal or a source of deep shame. Maybe that's the reason why an older relative is so reticent about talking about his or her past in China, but also just that people are aware of some dark secret family, you know, skeleton or whatever, and they that's what sparks them to engage you guys. What are some of the more lurid things that you've come across?
Yeah, Claude, you want to go?
Sure.
There's so just an endless.
Plenty. The one I'm thinking of is one of our earlier clients whose grandfather was Chinese, but she was Dominican American, and she didn't know very much about him, and he never really spoke about his past. And then through our research, we discovered that some of his very close family members, his mother and one of his siblings, like, died of starvation or something horrible like that.
Oh,
and,
God.
And then suddenly she thought, oh, you know, that makes a lot of sense, you know, why he wouldn't want to stir up the past.
Oh, yeah, no, it makes total sense. Oh, that's awful.
Yeah, or another case where a great-great-grandfather had to flee the village because at age 16 he had killed another boy, like a fight that had gotten out of hand, and then just had to just really leave because of the inner village conflict. I mean, there are also a lot of family conflicts, basically, where, I mean, it's often about money.
Yeah. but also it's the case, especially I think in the US, where you had the Chinese Exclusion Act, and there was a whole wave of people who migrated in the early 20th century as paper sons under false identities. And so because they had to lie, but they were thoroughly, you know, interrogated by the immigration authorities at the time. If you look at some of these interview files, it's fascinating the amount of detail that these officers would ask. They'd ask them, you know, which village did you come from? How many people live there? Where is the school located?
How many steps are leading up to your front door?
Yeah, stuff like that. I mean, and so you had to get your story straight. So I think because of just the trauma of going through that experience, a lot of American clients come to us and they say, you know, my grandparents never really agreed to answer our questions about where they came from, probably because they were scared, and it's just the repercussions of this that they were still feeling.
Well, also, let's not forget that I think Chinese parents in general are pretty bad at talking about emotions and the softer side of things.
Yeah. I mean,
not to generalize. Yeah.
It is,
no,
it is a stereotype, right. but it's hard to say.
Well, we're not sure, though, whether that's actually genetic. And speaking of genetic,
sure.
You had to know I was going to ask this. What about DNA? I mean, there are all these services available now. I mean, I think they're quite popular from what I've heard in China. My wife actually says that they offer a whole ton more specificity about, you know, geographies within China. I mean, you do like Ancestry DNA or 23andMe, and it'll tell you like you're 97% East Asian. Oh, ooh. Yay! That really helps. I mean, yeah, not super helpful. Presumably, you guys could learn an awful lot if you did that. Can you comment on what your plans are for integrating or for partnering with companies,
sure,
that do use DNA sequencing, and what are some of the challenges around this in China?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, DNA is, we're now in the preparatory phases of setting up our DNA services. You just mentioned Ancestry DNA, and we're very happy to have one of the key people that actually built up Ancestry DNA as one of our hands-on strategic advisors in order to basically advise us on how to set up DNA services, but then in the Chinese context. So we're in talks with some laboratories, and hopefully next year it will be good to have another chat on the Cynica podcast so we can really launch our services then.
Yeah, you guys will have to actually do mine, you know, for free so that I can find
no
out.
No worries. I'll talk to the manager.
Uncover all these new lies that I was told for so long that I was descended from this particular Tang general, and just from my own cursory investigations, it turns out to be completely untrue.
Yeah.
Anyway, tell me more about where the company is right now. So what's your headcount at? How many of these cases are you able to take on, you know, like in a given quarter?
Sure. So we have two offices in Beijing and Guangzhou, and then we also have people in London, Paris, and Hong Kong. So we have a team of 11 full-timers and then 6 part-timers.
Oh, wow. It's really small.
Yeah.
It's like our company.
It's yes. I'm happy to say that we're really growing, though, especially in the past 2 years. Things have really taken off in terms of clientele, in terms of operations. And in the past 2 years, we've worked on an online database, so to exponentially scale up the people that we can reach out to and help. So far, what we've been talking about so far is clients that we help on a very customized basis. So we actually send people, our researchers go to ancestral villages, collect all the traces, et cetera, et cetera. But now what we're doing is we're putting all those traces in a database that people can search for.
And presumably the pricing structure would be different.
Exactly.
But right now for these sort of custom jobs, what does it typically cost? What would it set you back if you wanted to do a deep dive into your family ancestry in Guangzhou or
sure,
in Guangdong or in Fujian?
I mean, for pure research, it would typically average out to around 2,000 US. But important to say is that we have a success fee and a base fee mechanism, and that is designed to lower the risk on the client side if we don't find anything. So basically, clients pay off, start off with paying a lower amount, and then the more we find, basically, the higher the bill. But on average, it would come down to around 2,000 for research, and then depending on.
That seems very reasonable.
It is. It's extremely reasonable. And then if they want to have a report form either through in the way of a family website that Kristen was mentioning earlier, that will add another probably 2,000 US.
You set up something like that, and then they could then add, I mean, they're sort of the user-generated portion of it. Like you on that family portal, some cousin of yours can chime in with a story and post it directly to the site, or is that how it works, or upload photos?
Yes, definitely. So what we're building now is an online platform that consists of two parts. One is a database, and the database consists of data that we digitize and upload, but with time it will also consist more and more of user generated data. So exactly, if you have your own family website, then you can invite your aunt because you know that she knows more about your great grandfather, and she might have pictures. And so basically it's a concerted effort of all family members and users. And the second part of the online platform is family websites. So if people want to save, share, curate data that they find in our database, they can do so on very beautifully designed family websites.
That's terrific. Maybe just to wind up here, you could walk through a couple of your client cases. Ahead of our conversation, I'd asked you guys to dig up some clients who are willing to have their own research discussed by you, you know, whether by name or anonymously, either case, but on this podcast. So do you have one or two that you might be able to take us through, just sort of the broad brush outlines of what went into it, and maybe a little bit of that lovely prose I was talking about with the tableau describing the context of their lives?
Yeah, okay. So essentially what we do for clients is we go to the ancestral villages and collect all the traces that are left, right? So the two of the key traces are A, the Apu or Zupu, and B, what they call a gazetteer, because in county gazetteers there's a lot of information about the local environment. So what we're good at doing is combining the personal history that is saved in Tiapu and Zupu and combine it with things that we know have taken place in that town, village, county. So for instance, we can then say, if we know that your great-grandfather was born in 1880 in a particular village in Guangdong, well, you know, what flood was there when he was 9, then that basically killed 200 people and made, you know, the whole village help to reconstruct the village for months afterwards.
Basically, which horseman was riding through town?
Yeah, well,
which of the four horsemen? Right?
Yeah, but for you mentioned earlier things like the Taiping Rebellion, the Hakapunti Wars. These gazetteers have information about, you know, the extent to which a particular town was affected by, for instance, Taiping rebels or other cases of social unrest. Also, for instance, economically, you know, what are the key crops that were harvested in that area? What were the periods of sowing and harvesting? So it's goes to a very granular level, and we like to see our reports and our family websites as timelines. So it really allows you to go back in time and through the lens of your ancestors see and witness what was going on in 1900, 1800, 1700, going back like many, many centuries. And
yeah. Wow. You know, you guys should do like a VR representation of the ancestral village in a certain date. That would be so cool.
It's on our list.
Well, it will be very cool. Yes. I mean, what we're already working on is 360-degree footage of villages. Because another thing that is really important to mention is the fact that because of urbanization and industrialization, a lot of the villages are literally disappearing. I had the good fortune to visit one of my mom's ancestral village in Fujian, but today it's completely gone. There's just nothing left.
Oh wow!
There was a beautiful ancestral hall. There were tombstones on a hill. It was very picturesque and beautiful, and now it's just gone because of industrialization and local development. So what we feel strongly about is preserving these cultural treasures, because we wouldn't want to stop even economic development if we could. But what we can do is to preserve cultural heritage online and to let it live on virtually. So this is exactly what we do. You just mentioned VR. What we are designing is in our database for people to be able to visit their ancestral village virtually. So long distance, with the help of 360 footage and tools like Google Earth, but then using a different software.
I can't wait to see all that. That'll be amazing. Claude, did you find a passage maybe that you might?
Yes, definitely. So one of the clients we've done quite a lot of work for is American Chinese, and he had done quite a bit of research already, and he knew the stories of his, I think it's from his great great grandfather who first migrated to the U.S. During the for the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. And the interesting thing about this client is that he had three generations of men who all went to the U.S., so leaving their wife back in China, and they just went to make money for the family in the U.S. And so through the use of gazetteers and after conducting loads of interviews with villagers in China, we learned about loads of stories that of things that had been happening back in the village while they were away. So we also learned about the other side of the story. And that kind of comes back to this idea of, you know, picturing what might have happened if they had stayed if they had all stayed and then their descendants had stayed as well. And in his case, I think we learned quite a bit about his grandmother, who had been left in the village in the early 20th century. And it was quite a risky time. I mean, in Kaiping, which is one of the key counties that a lot of overseas Chinese come from, because you had a lot of rebels. And of course, then there was the Japanese invasion. So she was there through a lot of that. And then after the communists took over, she was also there during the Great Leap Forward. But when that started, she escaped to Hong Kong. So we learned about all these things that he didn't necessarily know about his grandmother, even if that was more of a recent story. But yes, the most interesting thing really was that three generations of his ancestors had all gone by themselves to the U.S., leaving wife and kids back home. Yeah.
Yeah, that was actually not untypical, though, at that time. Sort of the pattern, and weirdly, it even persisted in a way in San Francisco Chinatowns, where a lot of men would go back to their village and take a wife, and not necessarily even bring her over until she was pregnant.
Exactly.
At which point they would bring her over.
So, right. And you'd have entire villages who were sort of inhabited by these wives who had been entrusted basically with looking after their husband's parents. And they may have only spent a total of 2 years with their husbands in their entire life. So it's a little bit sad.
It's a lot of bit sad. Huh?
It's quite sad. But it also gave rise to a lot of kind of funny situations. For example, I think in Kaiping specifically, where this one client was from, they had this special custom in which when the groom could not be present because he was trying to make money somewhere on the other side of the ocean, you could have a cockerel stand in as a proxy. Yes. So the bride would actually marry a rooster instead of a person. So it's completely absurd, but that did happen.
There's a terrible joke that one could make about that.
But then that idea of like a stand-in, like in the absence of someone, it does take on like a very symbolic significance sometimes. Like there was one client, like Canadian Chinese, she went back to her grandfather's village and discovered like this whole building where they store the ashes of people in jars. And her grandfather had migrated to North America, but they had a jar for him, like symbolically for his ashes. So even though he never came back, they were like, you know, there's still a place for you here.
Oh, wow.
So that was very moving for her.
That's something very particular in China, is that the idea when these people left all those years ago, the idea was always that they would return. So it's almost natural that we as descendants would want to find out where we come from and find our roots. And it's natural to have an ancestral tablet or an urn that has the symbolic ashes of our ancestors still there.
You know, I'm getting this real distinct sense that you're not just a genealogical service, but you're really playing a role in cultural heritage preservation, and that's a really great thing about this company.
We like to think so.
It's really cool what you're doing. I love it. And we need to tell our listeners what they can do if they're interested in engaging your services. Where can they find you online?
Sure. Anybody that's interested to hear more, go to www.mychinaroots.com. And anybody that's interested in partnering on a more long-term basis, we are currently raising a second angel round to build our mature platform and our database. So let us know. Basically, you can find all our contact information on our website.
Okay, Kuihan, that's great. Kuihan Li, Chris Lin Chu and Clotilde Yap, thank you so much, all three of you, for taking the time to chat about this. It's fascinating what you do. And I think Ming and Qing historians who don't land tenure track jobs, maybe this is kind of a line of work that you might take an interest
well,
in.
Well, not really just good. Ming and Qing historians, right? Just anybody interested in stories, but also now that we're working on the database, basically software engineers, big data, as well as AI. People with an AI background, we're looking now to recruit those types of people because we are looking into pattern recognition of these zupus, of cemetery records. So anybody in big data or AI, come find us.
So let's move on now to recommendations. But before we do, I want to remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. The best thing you can do if you like the work that we're doing for this podcast or any of the other shows in the network is to sign up for our SubChina Access membership. For just $8.88 a month, you get a daily in-depth newsletter that's a roundup of all the big China news. Plus, you get access to our Slack channel, you get discounts to our big conferences, and free admission to events like our monthly live podcast in New York. Okay, so now on to recommendations. Since Jeremy is not here, why don't we start with Clotilde, and then Chris Lin, and then Hui Han, and then I will go last. So, Chloe, you are up. What do you got?
So I'm a massive foodie. And in my free time, to relax, I love to try and cook Chinese dishes that I used to eat all the time in China. And I found this great food blog that I've been using a lot to cook all of the classic Chinese foods that I love so much. It's called The Omnivore's Cookbook, and it's great. The author is from Beijing, and her recipes are really clear, really easy to follow. Totally advertising for her, but
oh wow, that's great. You know what I just got? Fuchsia Dunlop. So I just got a galley copy of the new Fuchsia Dunlop book, which is an update to her classic book on Sichuan cooking. And so I've just this morning over breakfast I was studying one of her recipes, which I am going to attempt to execute tonight. Well, my wife's not home, so that if I screw it up too badly, she won't. I'm not like a cookbook person. I just usually just wing it, but I'm gonna try it the way that Fuchsia suggests. And we're planning on having her on the show when she's through the States on book tour. So that's great.
Omnivore's Cookbook.
Oh, The Omnivore's Cookbook. Okay, and it's an online blog. That's great.
Yeah.
I think, that's the reason why I keep an iPad in the kitchen. Okay, Chris Lin, what do you have for us?
I'm a huge story nerd, and so my recommendation is TVtropes.com. It's like a Wikipedia for all narrative junkies out there. For me, my background is in, you know, video production and film and all these things, I've actually seen I've watched very few movies, because for me, a movie is more than just 2 to 3 hours. It's like at least an 8 to 10 hour commitment, because once I'm done watching the movie, I have to go and like consume every single behind the scenes thing, every alternate, you know, plot they considered, like every analysis of this, alternate people they considered, blah, 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 blah. And I just get so sucked into the world. And if you go on TV Tropes, literally like any story, movie, whatever genre of story that you can think of, it's brilliantly with like a wicked wit kind of dissected and organized for you. So you can just go and binge and feed your craving to know what happens to your characters, or what might have happened if, you know, someone else was cast in Pulp Fiction, or every single spoiler, or it's just all there. So that's my like... whatever black hole that I get sucked into.
Oh yeah, that's a serious rabbit hole. I found myself doing the same thing, and it's dangerous. I mean, I try to watch a movie and not hit pause and use X-ray on Amazon Prime, or you know, I always have like Wikipedia open while I'm watching anything, so I'm always stopping. But I have this terrible habit of spoiling myself, like reading the next episode. I watched a movie last night, actually. I stayed up kind of late and watched Always Be My Maybe, which was pretty good. I have to say,
it was pretty good.
New one
I really liked it.
Yeah, Ali Wong it was fun.
That's awesome. Go look it up on TV Tropes.
Yeah, I might do that. Okay, Hui Han, what do you have for us?
Well, when I'm not working on any roots-related things or pretending to be a hyena or a cobra or a dinosaur with my two very young kids, music is my thing. I'm a drummer, a jazz drummer. So when you ask me about recommendations, the first thing that came to my mind is Haitian Fight Song by Charles Mingus. So it has absolutely nothing to do with what we've been talking about, but it's just do you know it?
I listen to a lot of jazz. I'm not as fanatical as I ought to be, but it's one genre of music that my wife lets me play at all hours at any time, and she's completely, you know,
I've been, I like your wife,
raiding vinyl stores and finding good old pressings of jazz classics, so I'll keep an eye out for more Mingus. Haitian Fight Song, huh?
Haitian Fight Song, yeah, it's the most intense, greasy, fat, ugly, just in your face music playing that just
nice.
Combining history and future into a beautiful story, basically.
Wow.
I'm gonna make a musical recommendation too. So if you're in China this summer, keep an eye out for this great band from Richmond, Virginia. They're heading to the PRC to play a whole bunch of shows in you know, cities all over the place. I took a look at their tour, and it's like 20-something cities. It's pretty great. They're called Colin Phils, like, you know, in an inversion of Phil Collins. Colin Phils, and it's kind of a weird name. But I saw them the other night here in Chapel Hill at the Cave. They met, actually, while teaching English in Seoul, and then they all relocated to Shenzhen. So they were in Shenzhen for like a year, and they all went back to the States a couple of years ago. They self-fund these tours of China, where they've been really, really well received, and not surprisingly, because these guys are consummate musicians. I mean, they are
nice.
Like the drummer, he studied, you know, drums. He's a classical percussionist, and he's just a killer on a kit drum. They have really ample chops, but they put them to work in the service of really good songs. And it's weird because they have kind of an indie feel to them, but they're you know, unlike a lot of indie, they actually know how to play their instruments, but they're not just showing off. They're one of those rare bands that I think musicians would really love, but so too will have, you know, no idea at all about chord progressions or modes or time signatures. They're playing all over China in July, so check them out. Colin Phils.
Curious now.
Definitely, they're going to be at school. Really good, really really great outfit.
So, are there some reverse Phil Collins influence there? Or?
You know, the funny thing is, he professes a completely unironic appreciation, and, you know, as do I.
Oh,
for Genesis,
Genesis,
Genesis, and also, you know, I played him. They all came over to my house the other night. I played him Brand X, and if you've not heard Brand X, it's just the most amazing 70s fusion band. If you're into stuff like that, anyway, sort of addendum recommendation: the band Brand X, Phil Collins, killer guitarist named John Goodsall, I think is his name, John Goodsall, and then Percy Jones, who plays a lot of fretless bass.
Okay.
It's just amazing, amazing combo.
Oh, now I'm curious.
All right, guys. Hey, check them out. Thank you so much. What a fun conversation. And I really encourage anyone to check out your website and to see what you guys are doing. So thanks once again.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much, Kaiser.
Thank you all. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, and our two shows focused on women, New Voices, and Ta for Ta. Oh, and don't forget the Middle Earth Podcast, an excellent show on the culture industry in China. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.